Disinformation, as you know, has been infecting many sectors of our society, in science, in healthcare, of course, in elections and voting. And during this election season, we are expecting more and more deepfakes. So how do we protect ourselves? Barbara McQuaid has been writing about this. She's a former U.S. attorney, now law professor at the University of Michigan. And her new book is Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barbara McQuaid, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Scott.
You know, we've been hearing about falsehood, lies in society, in American politics. You argue in your book, this is at another level.
Yeah, I think there are two things that we're seeing right now that are real game changers. One is the ability to spread a falsehood to millions of people with a push of a button, and now with artificial intelligence to create the impression that someone said something they didn't say or did something they didn't do. We've allowed technology to grow, but it has reached the point we need to check it and rein it in a little bit without running afoul of the First Amendment. Put in place common sense rules that can help us eliminate disinformation, but still allow us to communicate with people all over the world. But I think the other thing that is happening is political actors who are working hard to push us apart. It seems many of us are choosing tribe over truth. That is, we know that things are not true. We know that the election wasn't stolen. We know that people who have been arrested for the January 6th attack are not hostages. And yet people choose to engage in conversation about these things as if they are true because they care more about winning, more about their own team than they do about country. Those two things have really put us in a place that's very different from any other time in American history.
We have to talk at least briefly then about the 2020 election. You know, Donald Trump lost, and help us understand the interaction between the lie and the people who repeat it and the people who wear it on their shirt.
Yeah, so I think people probably fall into one of two categories: those who actually believe the lies and those who know they're not true but go along with the con anyway because it's in their political self-interest to do so. Like Elise Stefanik, congresswoman from New York, I don't believe for a second that she thinks that election was stolen, and yet she repeats Trump's claims that the people who are in prison because of their role in assaulting police officers on January 6th are hostages. She is willingly going along with the con there. But some of the tactics that Donald Trump and his supporters have used are some of the same tactics used by authoritarians throughout history. I talk about it in the book. Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf that there are two things that are essential for a lie. One, keep it simple and repeat it over and over and over again from many sources so that people will believe it to be true. So stop the steal. People heard it from Trump. They heard it in courts. They heard it in the media, and they believed it to be true. And the other essential component to a lie is to make it a big lie. We all lie from time to time in small ways, but what Hitler wrote is ordinary people cannot imagine that anyone would have the audacity to lie about something so significant, so huge, it would not enter into their minds to believe it to be false. So in a very twisted way, the bigger the lie, the more likely we are to fall for it.
Wow.
And so Trump and his supporters have pushed this idea that the election was stolen, and now it has become a way of signaling your membership in the group. Not so much whether you believe it or not, but you say the election was stolen because that's what signals you as a member of the far right extreme MAGA part of the party.
So the question then is, if a third of the country doesn't believe that Donald Trump lost, where do we go from here?
Yeah, and I am concerned we're going to see a number of efforts just designed to make people check out of politics and not participate. So I think there are a number of things we can do. One is, we need to work to build resilience in our democracy. And that is, people will be discouraged. They will say, I don't know what to believe. I've become cynical. There's so much lying in politics. Who knows what to believe anymore? And we have to bolster up our neighbors and make them feel your vote does matter and remind them this is the only way we have the power of the people. So encouraging our friends and neighbors to get out there and vote. Looking for credible sources of information. And I also encourage people to read and look at what some conservative and some progressive voices are saying so that you're not in the kind of thought bubble and exposing ourselves to other ideas where lies can be challenged.
You know, the news media can amplify some of these lies by repeating them. I want to ask you about the role of the First Amendment. And you write, the way the legal system works in this country it allows a lot of things to be said, even falsehoods. Yeah, that's just how it works.
It is. You know, we cherish our First Amendment right to free speech as well. We should. It's essential in a democracy. But it does allow a lot of room for people to say things that aren't true. You know, a good remedy for speech is more speech. And so we need to all get out there and debunk myths. We can do it. We can do it politely. We can ask them for the evidence to support their claims and hope that through kindness and grace, we can get people to look for a little evidence and maybe question things without accepting them as truth.
Barbara, you offer some solutions like making domestic terrorism a federal crime, making doxing a crime. What do you think that would do? What would that change?
Well, I don't think any one solution will solve all of our problems. But one concern I have is disinformation is causing harm to public safety. And so as we saw on January 6th, when people believe their country is being taken from them, and when they believe that law enforcement isn't doing their job, they become inclined to take the law into their own hands. So domestic terrorism, for example, we have created a lot of laws in this country to make it illegal for people to engage in international terrorism. But we don't have a counterpart for purely domestic actors. And I think the reason for that is concern about violating civil liberties and the like. But when it comes to violence, people have clearly crossed the line of what is acceptable and what is not. And I think the lack of a domestic terrorism statute is what causes the FBI to be unable to investigate when they learn about risks. For example, what we saw on January 6th, the FBI was very hands-off in terms of investigating that threat. Everybody could see was coming. And I think it was because they didn't have a statute to hang their hat on. So they were concerned about allegations that they might have been overreaching. So if we had a domestic terrorism law on the books, we might be able to avoid that kind of situation in the future. And then with regard to doxing, you know, after 2020, we saw a number of public officials, those who refused to play ball. You know, there were some officials in the state of Michigan, Republicans, who refused Donald Trump's requests to cast a new slate of electors. And when they did so, their phone numbers were posted all over social media. And so holding people like that accountable through criminal laws, same with regard to some of the threats we're seeing against public officials and the swatting that we're seeing against public officials, that is just not okay. And we need to send a strong message that it's not. And I think one way of doing that is by holding people criminally accountable.
Barbara, I want to ask about how you think about the stakes here. You know, you quote authors, researchers who think about how democracies live and how they die. And you suggest that perhaps ours, our democracy in the U.S., has outlived its natural life. What do you mean?
Yeah, I hope that's not the case. But there's a great book that I cite in my book by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt called How Democracies Die. And it talks about how authoritarians can seize power from the people and then use that power against the will of the people. I hope we're not there. We have the power to reclaim our democracy, but the stakes are very high. I think it's easy to assume that governments only tumble in times of war and when there are tanks in the streets. But in some ways, I feel like our democracy is undergoing a slow erosion where people surveyed say, democracy is not the point. We're a republic and prosperity is the point. And so I'm willing to accept a little less freedom if it means I'm wealthy. And if we think about how that ends, it doesn't end well for the people. And so I'm hopeful people understand the stakes. You know, we've lived through the 2016 election and the 2020 election. And although, as you say, there's a third of the country who believes the 2020 election was stolen, that leads two-thirds of us who want to fight for truth. And so I am hopeful through my book and other conversations like this one, we can help people identify some of the tactics of disinformation. Then we can reclaim our power and elect people in this country to be leaders who want to unite us and find compromises so that we could advance public policy and social agendas that will lift all boats and help people and not live in a world of winners and losers.
The book is Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. And the author is a friend of the show, Barbara McQuaid, former U.S. attorney, now a law professor at the University of Michigan. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott. Really appreciate it.